Admiral Balfour Rialto.
Well, now we were within 300 miles of the TEZ, the protected zone around the Falklands, and this was the morning of the landing, and we had set watch on as many circuits as we could. We had no op order, we had no information as to what communications were to be used, or what our mission was when we got there. We didn't know whether we were going to join the landing. We knew from the World Service and one or two signals that the landing was likely to take place that day. And then we listened to and heard spasmodically the warning circuit, which was on high frequency, and were able to pick it up, and it became quite reliable. So that gave us an immediate and positive source of information. And it was an uncanny feeling listening to a above-water warfare officers in Brilliant and other ships in Carlos Water and the Sound being attacked and being bombed. And that really did sharpen the ship's company up enormously. We were now, as it were, in the hot area. The battle had started for real. The landing had begun. And we were within a day's steaming of taking part. I didn't say on the way down that we had, in one of the tankers, we met Sam Salt and some of his crew from the Sheffield who were on their way north to go home. Sam was an old friend, and he came across, despite the weather, to brief us on the sort of pitfalls they had found in damage control particularly. And this was invaluable to us. It gave us a real feel for the sort of things that we could do. Now, we'd had a signal from UK saying what the immediate experience was, but there's nothing like personal contact. And I was pleased to be able to give Sam a glass or two and to pick his brains, and that also helped. So by the time we actually arrived in the hot area, as it were, we had had an excellent workup with the Americans. We had had plenty of time to think about how to get ourselves ready. We had a measured pace in preparation, and now we'd had first-hand experience of what to do if things do really go wrong. So we couldn't really have been better placed to join in.
When did you go to join the San Carlos landing?
No, we thought we were more likely to be sent there because that would be the centre of activity. So we headed for the Sound. But in fact, just as we'd sort of within 12 hours of being there, we eventually got our instructions. We got what is called an Opgen Alpha, which is a sort of statement of who's in command and who's doing what. And at last, we had a sort of picture. And so we were directed to join the battle group, which was about 150 miles to the east of the Falklands, and act as a picket. And it was, in fact, that role which we carried out for very much most of the time, really. We were down there. The Type 42s, with their missile systems, were placed out from the battle group at about 18 to 20 miles. If there were three, you'd obviously have one on either bow and one ahead. Sometimes we were down to just one, which made a choice of where to put the picket very difficult. But our job was to be out front, to give warning, and to try and take out any low-level raid with Exocet before they got in range of the carriers.
Which position in the picket was Exocet placed?
Well, we were put in all the different slots from time to time and ended up being on our own on a number of occasions. Because as the battle unfolded, by now Glasgow had been damaged, so she was out of it. Sheffield had been sunk, and we were the first reserve. So there were only two when we got there. That was Coventry and ourselves. And so we were split on either bow, which was a very sensible way of playing it.
What was the first occasion when the enemy appeared?
Well, before really, I think one talks about the instance. I think some of the atmosphere on joining is quite interesting. Apart from the lack of information, we were now actually there. We felt very like a new boy at school. the others had been together for a long time. They'd got used to this sort of ad hoc command arrangement where you just got on with it and weren't entirely certain what was going on, but you knew your bit and you just did your bit. And we found that very difficult because we didn't have any experience. We didn't know what the form was. We had the usual false alarms. As soon as you're actually in the groove, as it were, everyone's slightly heightened in their tension and they start hearing things that aren't there. So you've got torpedo warnings when somebody has switched a piece of machinery on. Well, you only do it once, and you're allowed to get away with it once. The others had all done it ages ago. We had to learn these things. So we had a settling in period of about 24 hours where people were on edge, and you just had to settle them down. I found some of these techniques helpful. I read a book in the operations room, sitting in my chair. I have to admit, I never got further than about page 3, but the ops room team never realized that. I also slept in my chair in the operations room and annoyed them intensely by not really being asleep and saying, I don't agree with you, I think you ought to do this, out of the blue. But again, I think it helped to create an atmosphere of controlled calm and helped people settle down to getting on with the routine. And there's nothing truer than the old adage that war is 90% boredom and 10% panic. And that is exactly it. The problem facing the command is how do you keep people alert, particularly if you're the picket who's going to get the first warning of being any attack. How do you keep them alert and on the ball for hour after hour when really it's a pretty soporific atmosphere being in an operations room? It's dark, you've got all looking at these radars, you have sort of buzzing noise and machinery. There's nothing more conducive to falling asleep. So you have to think of ways of keeping people awake and alert. And they were remarkably good at it. So we sort of took 48 hours to settle down. We were very grateful for the UHF secure speech circuit where we could talk to other commanding officers. I knew one of the watchkeeping captains in the flagship, Andy Buchanan, very well, a submariner, and we served together at the tactical school. So I was able to sort of get quite a lot of information out of him. And really our first 2 or 3 days was frustrated by our inability to get rid of any of this mail or stores. It took us 4 days eventually to actually get rid of it all. And I felt this was very worrying that had all these helicopters about, but we never seemed to be able to get rid of this stuff. And people didn't seem to appreciate, I think, that we had valuable stores which people needed. And what happened if we got sunk? We'd lose all this lot. Apart from the morale value of people getting mail, and some of these ships had had no mail for some time. So there were a lot of irritations, as it were. We had to be very careful. We were still applying the principle of keeping our mouths shut and offering no advice, and which paid off, I think. But on the other hand, we were desperately trying to poke people into actually doing something. And eventually, as I said, after 4 days, we got rid of all our stores, and this allowed us to clean the ship up and make best use of all the spaces available.
So you were actually in the picket line with all these stores still aboard?
Yes, we were. And it was a worry. It somehow felt wrong that we weren't able to clear these things out. Our daily life was quite straightforward. We were pretty sure that the Argentinian aircraft were going to do their attacks by day because they were mostly single-seat aircraft and they needed the daylight. And so this helped a lot. There were two distinct periods of attitudes. When it was daylight, you could be on the ball and really sort of worried. Short notice attack. You, at night, felt that somehow you could unwind that level a bit. Now this was one of the key decisions that a captain has to make, and one which we were really unprepared for, mentally, I think, because you can't train for it, is when do you go to action stations and when do you increase the readiness of your ship? And for those who may not quite understand this, in a modern ship you have two watches, both capable of fighting the ship. One is on and working. The other is asleep or relaxing. Now, in order to be able to fight your ship from a damage control point of view, you need to get those who are sleeping out of the bottom of the ship and so you can shut it down. You also need a little extra help. But this creates two problems. You're bound to have a first 11. Of the two watches, you're bound to have a team where some people are better or more apt to have better aptitude for certain tasks. So you have a feeling in your water that you'd rather fight the enemy with Jones and Smith rather than Bloggins and Burt. On the other hand, you can't interrupt their life cycle or they get very tired, and that is counterproductive. So you go to action stations, you get the first 11, which hopefully are the people you really want, but you've broken their sleep pattern, you've interrupted the way of the ship. And so this was the biggest single decision and the most difficult that the captain had to make. When did you go to action stations, and when do you take a deep breath, cross your fingers and say, no, I'm not going to? Neither was a measure of advance warning from various sources which gave an indication that there might be an air attack developing. You didn't know whether this air attack was going to go for the Falklands and the land forces or whether it was going to go for the battle group. And so we did begin to rely considerably on this advance warning to help us make this very difficult decision as to whether to go to action stations or not. And it was, on both occasions, the force was attacked by Exocet firers. We were fortunate enough to be alerted to the fact that this was a period of high risk, and no more than that. But that makes a lot of difference, because you can go to action stations, you can settle down, and everybody knows why you've gone to action stations and accepts it, and you're in the best possible position. Now, Sheffield, unfortunately, wasn't in that position when she was attacked. They hadn't had that sort of warning, and so they had this very short notice of suddenly seeing something and having to respond with people in a pretty relaxed state. So we were very lucky that by the time we were there, the alertment system was working reasonably well, and one had a feel for the sort of likelihood of an attack developing. That's not to say that it might be badly timed or in fact incorrect, because the raid went to the Falklands and not to you or something like that. But this was the key decision, and it still is and always will be, when do you go to action stations? And I talked with many people when I got home, those particularly who'd been in the Falklands, in the Second World War rather, and they said that it was exactly the same problem in the Second World War and in Korea. When do you mobilise your ship's company? and you're very conscious of the risks that if you don't, you have put people's lives at risk by not being fully prepared.
And your first Argentinian attack?
Well, the first attack was on the 25th of May, which we were pretty all certain that, being the sort of Argentinian national day, and their aircraft carrier being called the 25th of May. So that was 4 days after we joined. And so we were very certain that there would be a raid. And Sandy Woodward, again, who I knew very well, we were great friends and sparring partners, and I forgive him for his outrageous comments about me in his book. And I won't write a book in order to get my own back. But we were great friends, and this helped. And he said to me on the morning of the 25th, or the night before, I'm going to send this Type 22-42 combination inshore again, because I'm sure something's going to happen. Now, this was a gambit. The Royal Navy had developed its missile ships and escorts on a blue water concept, that is, they would be miles offshore. This was a complete delusion, really, in policy, because all our contingency plans had us going to Norway or somewhere in war and taking us inshore. But the implication of that was, or the consequence, was that we were not fitted with close-range weapons against fighter ground attack aircraft. All our weapon systems were long-range standoff weapons. And they were all, and all our sensors and warning was based on the fact that we would have airborne early warning from shore or from an American carrier. And so here we were in the South Atlantic with no airborne early warning to give warning of low-level attack. And we had no close-range weapons in the Type 42s. They were originally going to have it, but as a savings measure, it was cancelled. So we had a very good medium-range system, but nothing inside it. Rather like a boxer with long arms, but no short punch. Now, we were in a situation where what we really needed was short punches. and not long arm ones. And so Sandy Woodward devised, on the advice of his COs, this combination of a Type 42 and a Type 22 working within 1,000 yards of each other. The 42 with its guided weapon system 30, with a range of 30 miles and, or so, and 30,000 feet, 40,000 feet, the C-DART system. And the Type 22 with its C-WOLF system, which was brand new and untried, which is a close-range 10-mile system and designed as an anti-missile system. And this had been successful so far and had been tried. And he said to me, I think it's time you had a break from being a picket, so I think tomorrow you better go with Brilliant and be a combination, and I want you to go off the north-west side of the Falklands and try and achieve attrition of Argentinian aircraft. Well, in fact, I got a telephone call, as it were, on the secure speech about 2 hours later saying, I've changed my mind. I think it's you haven't done this before. I think it's too serious. It needs to try. I've talked to the captain of Brilliant, and he thinks it's better if he takes Coventry because they've done it together before. And as history relates, I'm very glad I wasn't there, but I wonder whether luck would have been different if we had been. Who will know? So on the morning of the 25th, Coventry and Brilliant were inshore, and I was left on my own. Now the question was, which bow should Sandy put me on? I couldn't be on both. There was no point being straight ahead, because that was the one direction we knew the Argentinians would not come from. They were bound to take a flank. So I think he tossed a coin and put me to the southwest on the basis that he thought that's what would happen. And so the Coventry Brilliant sadness occurred, and that evening, and which we, of course, we didn't know about at the time. But also the Argentinians made their second attack with the AM-39 exocet, and sadly they came in from the northwest, and so there was no DDG picket in that direction. There was a Type 21 who gave the warning and did her best, and the force was alerted in good time, but the missile was fired, missed her, and because it had been seduced by chaff, it flew on. And this is one of the troubles with missiles, is that if you manage to distract them from yourself, it doesn't stop them flying on. It flies through the chaff and goes on to the main body. And this was the night when Atlantic Conveyor was hit as a secondary target. And an exocet going into a merchant ship like that had dramatic effects. And very quickly she was on fire and sank. And this was a great loss to the force, because she had the forward operating base for the Harriers and was going inshore that night to land them the next morning. So by 12 hours, she was caught. And it had a serious impact on the build-up of the land forces and their mobility, and also our ability to put aircraft ashore in Carlos to operate from there in support of the army. And this was an enormous setback. Nothing went wrong. It was just bad luck. Invincible fired missiles at the target, but she wasn't in a position to take out the exocet. And, as I said, Coventry by this time was sunk off the Falklands, and we were on the wrong bow, and you can't blame anybody for that. It was just bad luck. So now the Argentinians had two successes with their AM-39. Sheffield, which was, I think, a learning curve for everybody. The first one is always a problem. The second had been a success, but with a great deal of luck in it, but no failures on the part of the force to detect the attack and to take the right responses. But it was a sad day. We'd lost Coventry. Brilliant had been hit, but not seriously damaged, and Atlantic Conveyor, with all her stores, aircraft, and the forward operating base, had been sunk. And fortunately, both incidents with remarkable lack of loss of life. Quite amazing that more people weren't either drowned or killed in the cold water.
So that was the 25th.
So the 25th was a bad day, a black day really. And I think it had a marked effect on morale. Everyone now felt, you know, this is really rather serious. The commander obviously was getting seriously concerned about attrition, and we were down to one DDG. But help was on the way. Bristol and Cardiff were due to arrive, and I think, I can't remember exactly, but I think they arrived the next morning. Certainly, by the, they were certainly there by the 27th. And this was an enormous boost to the force, because we could now deploy certainly two, if not three, DDGs to provide the sort of cover and warning which was essential.
How did the arrival of Bristol and Cardiff affect where you were allocated?
Well, again, we now had our own sector, and I tended to end up in the southwest for some reason, and Cardiff up to the north, and Bristol in the middle. So we had three DDGs, and this was the sort of number we needed. And that meant that if someone was fueling or somebody had to be detached to escort duties, there were still two, and both flanks were now properly covered.
When was the next time that the Argentinians came?
The next serious problem was the 30th of May, which 5 days later. And I'm sort of beginning to get a pattern, really. I think the Argentinian Air Force was now in serious difficulties of generating attacks. Their attrition was beginning to tell. And it does take time to generate attacks. Their aircraft were spread across many airfields over very large distances, and they had to regroup and then train and mount another attack. By this time, all the efforts in UK to establish how many exocets they had and to frustrate any plans for them to be increased had become to take effect. And we were pretty confident there was only one left, but we weren't sure. And we were never going to be sure. So we were fairly confident that they would take time to mount an operation. So the next serious incident, which was really Exeter's main involvement in, from a point of view of personal action, was on the 30th of May. Right in the afternoon, we were 150 miles or so west east of the Falklands. We were on the southwest picket station, and we had had alertment that there might be a raid, but it was considered that it was probably a raid going to the Falklands and not to the battle group. But we assumed that it could come to us. We then had a message from the flag saying that we were going to stand down from this raid in 5 minutes' time. And 30 seconds later, Exeter detected on our electronic warfare equipment the Entendard's radar, having two sweeps. That was all, just a bleep, bleep. Now, that's my speciality, and we had slightly different regime in Exeter. The UAA-1, which is the electronic warfare equipment, is luckily situated very close to the commanding officer, and the operator has a whistle round his neck, which is a very old-fashioned but extremely efficient way. And if he hears the enemy radar, he blows his whistle, and everyone shuts up. So the raid was detected on the first two sweeps by the Entendards. Now, we had no idea of range, of course, but we looked down the bearing on the radar, and we saw two aircraft at about 32 miles. So we knew that that's where it was, and we raised the alarm. Now, the aircraft were almost due south of us, not quite, and so they were still well away from the carrier. We were 20 miles out, and they were south of us, and they were flying north towards us. So that was the immediate problem. Now, in a Type 42, the missile radars are called 909s, and you have two of them, so you can fire at two things at once. And they are designed to, on a very, very narrow pencil beam, in a J-band radar, and when you've seen the aircraft on the sort of search radar, you lock your 909s onto the target, and then they know precisely where the target is in relation to you in terms of range, height, speed, and everything else. So you can track them in, and you get a response. Now, by locking on very quickly, the aircraft, who also have a warner of radars, are alarmed by hearing your J-band radar, and the I-band radar on the on the 909s, because they then know that they've been acquired and a missile might be on the way. And this is the most useful immediate response, because any pilot will start saying to himself, well, I'm not going to hang around here and decide whether the target I've got on my radar is invincible or extra or whoever. I'm going to get my missile off at something as soon as I can and push off, because otherwise I ain't going to be here. And so they had great respect for the SEADART system, because the Argentinians had two ships of their own. In fact, I worked up in another ship with one of them at Portland, and they knew how the system worked, and they respected our abilities to make good use of them. So I think the Entendard pilots, and as history relates, there were two aircraft at this stage, had come up, had a look, not actually seen anything, gone down again, flown into about 28 miles from us, come up again, and this time we again got their radar and knew where they were, and were locked on, and I think they then released the missile. Now, we all know from the history now that there was one missile on the aircraft, but with the Entendards, in order to confuse us, because this was the last missile, they had flown four A4 aircraft, which was a remarkable mission. They were miles, miles away from Argentina. They'd refueled many times to get there, a single-seat aircraft, flying with the Entendards, to come in over the top of the missile to distract the defences so the missile would get through. Really a remarkably efficient and exciting operation, and great respect for the Argentinians for setting it up. And it was a good operation by anybody's standards, and a brave one, because the risk of losing those aircraft, even just from hazard, was quite high. So here we were, it was for real, and one's first reactions are, my God, this is for real. Your adrenaline then starts running. And my first personal problem was trying to control myself in allowing the team to get on with the job. But you learn in your first occasion for real that, rather like dying, I suppose, when everyone says life is presented before you, suddenly a split second seems to take an hour, and you have all the time in the world to go through your drill in a logical and sensible way. And although I was cursing, and I think the bridge tape recording has been destroyed, my team into further action, in fact, they beat the fleet records of acquisition, getting a missile away, by about 50%. So they did extremely well, and I was very confident they would. They were a very well worked up, efficient team, and very calm. So what's the job of the captain? Well, now your team's doing the job. There's nothing you can do to help them except to watch. But we had one major problem. As soon as we detected these aircraft, we knew what was going to happen. We didn't know about the A4 aircraft with them, so we were looking for the missile. But my biggest problem of all was something I never really thought would be a difficulty, and that was safety, because Murphy had decided that on the bearing of the target, there was Avenger, Type 21, at about 7 miles, crossing to the south of me to go inshore to carry out a bombardment that night. So she, by chance, was smack on the bearing. Also on the bearing was a Lynx helicopter returning.